There's a new book called Fade Up 26, The Movers and Shakers of Variety Television. If you're not familiar with the term variety television, it's because there isn't that much of what used to be called variety TV on the air anymore. There was an era where variety shows on television were hosted by the Smothers Brothers and then Glenn Campbell and Carol Burnett. Donnie and Marie had a show, Sonny and Cher. There was one called Pink Lady and Jeff. Lily Tomlin, Richard Pryor, Flip Wilson, Mac Davis, Tony Orlando and Dawn, The Captain and Tennille, all of them hosted primetime variety shows. Now, you could argue that American Idol, which is now off the air, and The Voice, which is one of the reasons American Idol is off the air, and things like So You Think You Can Dance, you could argue that those are all variety shows. But who are the people who have been responsible for putting these things on the air through not just recent years, but all the way back through the decades? Well, my next guest is one of the co-authors of the book and one of the people responsible for some of the greatest variety TV ever. His name is Steve Binder. He won Emmy Awards for a 1977 Barry Manilow special and a Cable Ace Award for Diana Ross in Central Park on HBO back in 1984. He also produced and directed the Elvis Comeback Special in 1968 and things like the Star Wars Holiday Special and the Chevy Chase Show and on and on and on. He's got a long resume, and I'm very happy to have him on with me this morning. Hi, Steve. How are you?
Hi, Paul. Pleasure to be with you.
Nice to have you on here. I've got to start with something on your resume that I absolutely love, and I've always wanted to talk to somebody who was involved in it, and you are the guy, and that is a movie that you made in 1964 called The Tammy Show, T-A-M-I, which stood for what?
Teenage Awards Music International.
It was a concert, essentially a concert shot on camera that had Chuck Berry, The Supremes, Smokey Robinson, Marvin Gaye, Leslie Gore, Jan and Dean, The Beach Boys. The Rolling Stones closed the show, and right before the Rolling Stones closed it, you had James Brown with the flames behind him in what I think is probably one of the greatest filmed performances of all time. Would you agree?
Well, who'd have thought that in 1964, I think when we did it, I think 9 out of the 11 performers that you just mentioned are all now enrolled in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
Nobody would have predicted that when we actually booked the show and booked all the talent on the show. And I was fortunate enough to meet a crazy, wild producer named Bill Sargent from Oklahoma, who had the idea of using electronic cameras, meaning multiple cameras, and shoot a concert, which we did in California at the Santa Monica Civic. And, you know, it turned out, you know, I was amused when Quincy Jones was in a recording of We Are the World, said, you know, check your egos at the door. Well, when you think of the talent on the Tammy Show and the fact that there were no egos involved, everybody was thrilled that we were getting to make a real motion picture as opposed to appearances on television at the time. And I was at the right place at the right time, I think you could say. It is in the Library of Congress now, and in all these years, it's amazing we're still talking about it, but I've never, ever read a negative review from anybody on the Tammy Show. It's just been a something that I'll always have in my career and always be proud of.
I would urge my listeners to go find streaming versions of this or get it somehow and watch this thing, because it still stands up. It is still terrific. Is it true that it was the first time on TV for both James Brown and the Rolling Stones?
Yes, the Stones had just come over from England and were on their first tour here. James Brown, who was really, you know, without question among all the artists on the show, he was the true superstar. In fact, there's some funny stories involved where he came to me and I said, it's time to rehearse. And he said, you'll know what to do when you see me, so I'm not going to even rehearse for cameras.
And, really?
That's right. And then when I told him he was going to precede the Rolling Stones appearance, he looked at me and said, "Hey, Steve, nobody follows James Brown." And I understood after we shot the film, you know, why he said that. He was unbelievable. But you know, Paul, who the biggest star was in that at that time in the entire roster of talent on that film?
No, who?
Leslie Gore. She was unquestionably the hottest artist in America at the time and the most important star in the show at the time that the talent was booked.
She was best known at the time for a song called It's My Party.
And Judy's Turn to Cry
right.
was another one of her huge hits.
Yeah. But by the way, the thing you mentioned about James Brown having to be followed by the Rolling Stones, you have a shot in the movie of Mick Jagger in the wings. You know, they're getting ready. They know they're the next act. They got to come out and close the show. And there's a shot of him, and he looks like, who decided we should follow this?
Well, I think in a strange way, he metamorphosized himself into James Brown. After seeing James' performance, he went out there and almost tried to emulate him, you know. But, you know, I know that I think Keith Richards was interviewed once and said that it was probably the worst decision in their entire career was following James Brown. I happen to think it was the best decision ever made because I don't think we'd ever gotten an incredible performance from the Stones had it not been the fact that they followed him.
Now, as a director, how hard was it for you to stick with James Brown without a rehearsal? When you don't have that, you're not 100% sure what he's going to do on stage, and the rumors were that either was he.
Well, I think if you get the DVD of the show, which is really pristine, I'm amazed at how the quality of that looks. And I did a director's narrative on it, and I described in detail one of the luckiest moments in my career was my gut told me don't cut away from him when he was doing one of his great cape moves where he fell to his knees and then got up and so forth.
Yeah.
And so it was, the whole experience was, you know, nobody, including myself, ever thought we'd be here talking about it in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just pure fun. I mean, there's a little phrase I use all the time in my career, and I don't tell any of the management, of course, but I say, and they're paying me too.
Let me mention one of the other things in your credits here, and that is that Elvis Presley comeback special in 1968. I read in the book, and I'd never heard this story before, that before that show, you told Elvis the reason he should do the show is because his career was in the toilet, and that to prove that to him, you took him out on the street, and no one recognized him. This is 1968. Could that be true?
Well, it's only true because everybody in Hollywood at the time, all the guys who had any long sideburns and tried to emulate looking like Elvis. So since there was no announcement that he was in Los Angeles at the time when we did go out on Sunset Boulevard, I'm sure nobody who looked at him said, "That's really Elvis," rather than it was just somebody who was, you know, trying to look like him.
I gotcha.
So, but he never realized that himself, and I never told him.
And it was not called Elvis's comeback special. It was just, what was the full title of it? Just Elvis?
Full title was just Elvis.
Yeah.
That was the signature set where we had all these huge letters of the ELVIS in lights, and that became the signature. But you know, it was a case of where the only reason I got involved was that Elvis didn't want to do television. He felt he'd been made fun of a little bit, and you know, in those days the primetime shows were dominated by comedians like Milton Berle and Steve Allen and so forth. And when they had Elvis on, they were looking for a comedy angle. So they put a hound dog in front of him while he was singing Hound Dog on one of them. They had him dressed in tuxedos on others. So he never felt comfortable. And when the Colonel made the deal with NBC to help finance his next movie, and he would throw in Elvis doing a TV special, when he finally told Elvis, Elvis said, "I don't want to do that." And I just come off a Harry Belafonte, Petula Clark special. It was very controversial, and that's why I got the call from NBC saying we've got a commitment from Colonel Parker, but we don't have Elvis Presley, and maybe you can talk him into doing this.
And were you the one who decided I'm going to put Elvis in a much more casual setting, let him just sit in a chair with a leather jacket and play with his group and surround them with people and make it more intimate?
During the entire shooting, Elvis actually lived at the studio at NBC in Burbank. And every night after we would be rehearsing or taping a segment, he'd go in his dressing room, converted into his bedroom, and jam until 2, 3 in the morning. And I said, I've got to get cameras in the dressing room and capture this. I was blown away. I'd never seen anything like that. And the colonel kept saying, no, no, no. And finally, it's a long story, but after enough prodding, he finally said, well, if you want to recreate it on stage, you can do it, but I won't promise you it'll ever get on the air or into the show. And that's when I jumped on it.
Were you able ever to go around Colonel Parker and deal directly with Elvis?
Always. I never even dealt with Colonel Parker other than I knew how infuriated he was at me, and we had a few in-person confrontations where he was so unhappy that he didn't get his Christmas show. But you have to realize, Elvis joined my world. I didn't join the Elvis world. I had a well-polished group of talented people behind the scenes that I had worked with since early days of when I was directing Hullabaloo all the way up to doing these specials. And as a result, there was nobody from the Elvis world that was even involved in the comeback special. And they were there, but they were there strictly to hang out and entertain Elvis while he was there. They weren't participating in the making of the special. Those were all my people from previous shows.
Hi, I'm Paul Harris, talking with Steve Binder, a longtime producer and director of Variety Television, and one of the people included in a book called Fade Up, 26, The Movers and Shakers of Variety Television. Mary Beth Liedman is the woman who interviewed many of the people who were in there, including Nigel Lithgow and Lorne Michaels and other names you probably have seen in the credits of TV shows through the years, like Louis J. Horowitz and Glenn Weiss and Ellen Brown and Don Mischer, and the list goes on and on. How important is a director of a TV show to what we end up seeing when we're talking about a variety show? If somebody comes to you and says, okay, we've got this show and it's going to be hosted by, I know you worked for a while with people like Mac Davis or Liza Minnelli. How much is it your role to really create what we end up seeing on the screen?
Well, in shorthand, I think if you got on an airplane these days, 747, whatever, it'd be like flying the plane without a pilot. So a director is the key to everything. It's the person who everybody goes to and wants answers to their questions. And there's a wonderful speech that Ilya Kazan gave at Weimaran College years and years ago that the Directors Guild is printed, and it's on what is a director, and it he over-exaggerates, but it's the truth. You're the first one on the set, you're the last one to leave, and you're the one who every day, you know, you're the captain of the ship. You move it forward, and not only dealing with the talent, but dealing with the technical as well, and so forth. And I have great respect. When I started this book, and Mary Beth Liedman is really the motivator to really get me off my chair and say I'm really going to do it, we made a pact. Mary Beth Liedman is a professor at Indiana University of Pennsylvania, and she has a longer list of credits and credentials in the academic world as I have in the entertainment world. So it was a beautiful marriage. We really set out to do a textbook, and for anybody interested in who loves to watch television or who has any desire to be in the industry. And I said, I'll deliver all the talent. And I called all my friends. Everybody in the book is a personal friend of mine. And I never knew what they did. I mean, I knew them as personal friends, but I never knew what they did when they went on a stage and directed talent and the crews. So the book was fascinating to me. And the prerequisite is no Skyping, no iPhones, no telephone calls, etc. Everybody in this book spent 2 to 3 hours in person with Mary Beth Leedman, and her class put together 15 questions to ask all of us, and they range literally from what do you consider the definition of excellence in television, to who influenced you, specifically who do you think you influenced, and so forth and so on. So there were fascinating questions to be answered. It was sort of a Rashomon, if you remember that old Japanese film where there's a murder committed and then they interview people and they're giving their version of how it happened and they're all different. And that's what makes this book so, you know, fantastic. Tommy Smothers did the foreword, and he nailed it. He said, you may not know the names of all of us, but you certainly will know all the shows that we've all done. And that ranges from, you know, every major award show, from the Academy Awards, the Emmys, the Grammys, the Tonys, to, you know, everything we watch on television that we consider quality primetime variety. Not only the producers and the directors who are in this book, but we talk a lot about the crews we work with, the camera crews and the people who made us what we are. I mean, I came into the business with no relatives in it. I had no contacts, and I wasn't even planning when I grew up to be in the entertainment business. So it was strictly, you know, having an opportunity and going after it. And I think this book is a one and only. I've never there's two versions of it, actually. After the publishing company, Kendall Hunt, is a academic publisher primarily. And when they got into this, they were sold on the idea of making it a textbook, which we did. And after the textbook was published, the company itself said, you know, we got to get this out to the general public. Mm-hmm. And I was really pleased with that. And the obviously, the general public book is a lot cheaper to buy. I think it's under $30, a hardcover copy, and the information is fascinating, and I'm so pleased that nobody turned me down. That was the amazing thing. Everybody I called said, do you want to participate? And once they heard who else was participating, that's all they had to hear, and said, you know, we're in.
Well,
but not only are these my peers and contemporaries, but they're so talented, and you know, and just listening to their voices, all 25 of them, plus myself, I mean, it's just fascinating reading, and I hope people really take advantage of it and read the book.
Well, it is truly a who's who of, as you say in the title, the movers and shakers of variety television over the years, right up till Lorne Michaels today and all the other things that are on the air. Before I let you go here, I do have to ask, if you were to go back through your filmography, your resume on television, and could erase one thing, would it be the Chevy Chase show?
Absolutely not. I'm a great defender of Chevy Chase. When that show folded, Chevy didn't point the finger at anybody. He took 100% of the failure of the show on his own shoulders, very rare in any business where a person will take full responsibility. And the truth of the matter is that Chevy should have never done that format. When I was hired to do it, and I had experience years earlier with the Steve Allen comedy show,
yeah,
on Vine Street in Hollywood, and that was 2 years of some of the greatest, you know, training I ever got as a director.
Yep.
And it was a case of where, when they hired me, I said, I can't tell you what the Chevy Chase show should be, but I know what it shouldn't be. And that's basically what Fox insisted that Chevy do once we were on the air. They were telling all the people at the television stations that were carrying the show, he's going to beat Jay Leno, he's going to beat David Letterman, and they should have just quietly gone on the air for a year or so, let him learn the business of trying to do a 60-minute show a night. You know, and it was a case of where Chevy had never ad-libbed in his life. Even Saturday Night Live, as you probably know, or your listeners know, is a well-tight tightly written, scripted show. It's not ad-libbed at all. And, you know, Chevy had done one season of Saturday Night Live when it started on the air, and that was it. He was not a stand-up comic going around the country, you know, breaking in material and so forth. So when all of a sudden he's told, you've got to interview celebrities, which Chevy could care less about, which I discovered very early on. If anything, Chevy should have probably done what Bill Maher is doing today so successfully, and that's a political show, talking to politicians and so forth and so on, because Chevy's very intelligent, and, you know, I just think he was trapped in a, which happens, unfortunately, often in television. You know, you try things and some work and most don't.
Yep.
So, but I would not criticize Chevy at all. I think he had two strikes against him when we went on the air. And evidently, in a lot of his interviews when he was making his motion pictures, the interviewers themselves didn't like Chevy all that much, I guess, because, you know, I know for a fact that it took Jay Leno like a year where NBC sort of, you know, sent him to school on how to interview, and you know, Jay really focused on, which he was brilliant at, was his opening monologues. But it takes a lot more than an opening monologue to make an hour, five-night-a-week show entertaining each night. So I don't point my finger at anyone. You know, we all, when we hit the stage, give it 100% and do our best. And, you know, you have to let the chips fall where they may.
Yeah, well, it was an interesting experiment on the air, and it was obvious from day one that somebody had come up with a wrong idea for that show and that Chevy looked miserable from that first day.
And the truth is he was. And one thing that television live, which I happen to love, that part of the media, is you can't lie. I mean, whatever you're feeling emotionally comes across on that television tube, and it really is something where you know, in my opinion, if I look back at it, you know, he did as well as anybody going out, you know, starting up a show like that, etc. But you know, the reviews were just so scathing, and he didn't have a chance. And Fox was, unfortunately, critiquing him every single show. After he'd go off the air, they would put him in a room, and all their executives would walk in and critique all the negatives. And you can't. Performers are very fragile, and you have to build their confidence. And the stronger they feel you support them, the better they perform. And I'm a great believer in that.
I've had bosses in the radio business who tried to do the same thing with me. Hey, let's go back over the show and talk about what worked and didn't work. And I would always just say to them, I did the show. I know
exactly
what worked and what didn't work. We do not have to have a meeting and to be forced into that every day.
Yeah,
absolutely horrible.
First of all, entertaining people is subjective. And what one person loves, another person might hate. And you do your best. And as I said, you kind of hope for the best. And, you know, some of the best shows I've ever done have never been acknowledged or won Emmys or even been submitted for Emmys or whatever. Other shows, you know, where I've gotten the accolades and the pat on the back and, you know, you're the greatest and so forth. In my head, I'm saying, what made that so special compared to the other one that nobody paid any attention to, you know?
Wow. I'm glad to find out it's not just me.
No.
I will say this, Steve. In this book, all those other people who are in there are asked who were their influences, and many of them said Steve Binder. So you're a huge name in this business and deserve all the praise and the awards. And even on those shows that you didn't get the praise and the awards, you deserved it then. And it's an honor for me to talk to somebody who has worked with people like Steve Allen on his Westinghouse show and on that Tammy show, which I'm going to urge my listeners again to go out and get the DVD or see if you can find a streaming version of it. And so much of the other stuff you've done in your career. Congratulations on that and on the book, which is called Fade Up 26, The Movers and Shakers of Variety Television. Steve Binder,
what an a real pleasure talking to you, and I appreciate the opportunity. And I did not go into this writing this book, or this took 5 years to do, and I'm very proud of it, and I'm not even, you know, it was not done, I promise anybody who buys the book, it was not done for a profit factor. That was never brought into question. I had met Mary Beth Leedman. She was a professor when I was hosting an Academy of Television director's event for educators from all over the country that were in town at the time. And we had a panel discussion, and she came up as one of the professors and said, "We got to do a book together." And I'm really happy that she didn't let go, and we actually did it.
Yeah, I am glad you did, too. And I thank you again very much for your time today, Steve. A pleasure.
Thank you, Paul. Appreciate it.
Steve Binder here with Paul Harris. The book, again, Fade Up 26, The Movers and Shakers of Variety Television. This is the Big 550 KTRS.